You're listening to Seek Up, the Yoga Inspiration Show, right here on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio. I'm Keena McGregor, your host, world-renowned yoga teacher, author of multiple books, and founder of Om Stars, the world's first online TV channel. Get ready to raise your vibration and dive into the spiritual lessons from the yoga tradition. Even if you've never practiced yoga before, you'll find kernels of wisdom to help make your world a happier and more peaceful place. So let's dive in. Let's seek up and leave with a little dose of inspiration.
So I believe I gave a similar talk in June or May or something like this on what guru is. Maybe some of you have been there. So let's see where it goes today. What I was thinking to do is to talk for like half an hour. Usually half an hour becomes 3.5 hours. I'll try not to do that. And then do some Q&A, like have a little like question and answer, try to figure out maybe some question comes up about subject today, or about why Esmeralda is so mean when she's teaching primary students, or whatever might come up for you in this today, whatever questions there might be. Hey, Patty. All right. So yesterday when I was preparing for this, I was listening to some music and I was listening to David Bowie. And you know one of these like iconic songs he has, Heroes, you remember that one? I can be queen, you can be queen, we can be heroes, you remember that song?
Just one thing.
So I was thinking about perhaps the whole basis for this whole Guru Shisha, this whole Guru Disciple principle is that we all need a hero. We all need someone to look up to. We all need someone who lives a life that we can aspire to. We all need some kind of hope in our small pathetic lives. Or should I just speak for myself? And then the question is, who are we looking up to? Is it David Bowie? Is it rock stars? Is it movie stars? Like, who are we looking up to? And there's many different ways, and there's many different grooves. But some of us, we are looking towards yoga for these rock stars, these heroes. And in the... And I think what we perhaps are intrigued by is this long lineage of yogis, rishis, sages that populates the yoga tradition and whom we read about in obscure texts that has mastered obscure achievements. They can hold their breath for a long time, you know, and things like that. They can turn a cow into feeding a whole army, you know, things like that. So so we're looking perhaps to some of these heroes of a spiritual past. For sure, that has been my entry into yoga. At first, I was interested in it for two reasons. Because I found that the movements were very, very interesting, and in those days I was working as a choreographer and I was making dances, I was making theater pieces, and I thought that there was a whole pool of inspiration to draw upon in movement creation, in movement invention. And then second, there was my body was pretty broken because I'd had a big accident. So I was using it to heal. But perhaps on an even deeper level, I was looking for what I was just talking about before. Something that was uplifting to me. Someone to see and be around people that had found a key to living that was promising and inspiring. Something like that. And I've been working in the arts for a long time, and I think art was that for me. It was almost like a divine inspiration. But most artists, I don't know if you've ever worked in the art, they are as messed up as anywhere else in life. And what's nice about them is they usually don't cover it up. We expose all our miseries on stage every night. So it's like, that's kind of, I like that part. All right.
So
for us, perhaps in here, we're looking to yoga for our heroes. And when we start to look at yoga, we start to look at the tradition, we start to look at the parampara, we start to look at the lineage. Parampara literally just means someone handing down information from one person to the next person, from one generation to the next generation, and so forth. The idea here is that knowledge is sacred, and that knowledge can free, and that knowledge can improve lives, and that it needs to be passed from one person to another, from one generation to another. So what is important?
Yay.
Yeah, where did Patricia go? Yeah, where'd she go? So the idea is that one person needs to know something, take the knowledge on, and then pass that on to the next generation and make sure it doesn't get lost. There's a couple of ways it can get lost. It can get lost if the person that takes on the knowledge begins to contaminate the knowledge with non-time-tested new ideas, which is questionable or kind. That's one way. Another way that knowledge can be lost is that there's no one to pass it over to. That I sit with all this amazing knowledge, but none of you are interested. Or my teacher sit with all this knowledge, and I'm not interested. That's another way that it can get lost. So therefore, lineage is important. Lineage is necessary for evolution of mankind. So in our Ashtanga yoga tradition, we have Sharat, who is at the moment what we call the Parama Guru. Parama means the absolute, the primary guru of the Ashtanga yoga tradition. That is one way we can look at it. He is the holder of the lineage. He's the head of the lineage right now. I think that's how he looks at it. That's why he has to be called that. His teacher was Patabi Joyce, his grandfather. So in that regard, that's a bloodline. So we have grandfather passing it on to grandson. But Patabi Joyce's teacher was not in his family. He was from a different family. He is Krishnamacharya, he didn't have a wall on that. He was Patabi Joyce's teacher. He was also Iyengar's teacher. And many other yoga styles teach that. That's why we have him, because it's a little more inclusive to put him than to put Tom Joyce's Sharat 18 feet high out there. Krishnamacharya, again, he had a teacher. He was also not family. His name was Rama Mohan Brahmacharya. And from there on, we don't know where he got his information. That's as far back. We are all now part of that lineage. We are all part of that tradition. We are the new seeds on that branch. And let's see who of us is going to be the Paramaguru in the next generation. To see. Maybe Sukha, you can be. She's like, yes. She's want to get pet. Okay. One of the things that in this like yogic tradition is very important is that there is respect. There's respect from the teachers to the student. There's respect from the student to the teacher. Without the gratefulness, without the respect, without the appreciation, without the curiosity, no information gets passed along. Nothing gets learned. So today you notice that when we start, every time we start our class in Ashtanga Yoga, we say Vande Guru Nam. Basically what we say is, I will bow to the feet of the gurus and I will try to learn. I will try to learn the good knowledge from the doctor of the jungle. That's Patanjali. He's the doctor. He is in the jungle. What is the jungle? It's a wild, crazy, dangerous, dark place. And in there, many things can happen. And there's poison in the jungle. There's many, many diseases that can happen. And the teacher, the guru, in this case, Patanjali, is here to try to remove the poison and to instead teach us knowledgeable, useful, wise stuff. Yeah. So that little chant at the beginning is basically to say thank you, Patanjali, for bringing this information along through generations, through thousands of years. And part of that, what we're also saying is thank you to whoever has picked this up and is now presenting it to me. And today, that was Guru Ishmael. Okay, so how are you doing? So far, so good? So there's levels of teachers, there's levels of educators, which is very important. So before we come to Guruhood, which is kind of like, in this tradition, like the supreme version of it, we have friendship as a very good and first beginning of how to get information transmitted from one to another. If we have someone to share with, if we have someone who knows little less than us, who knows about the same as us, or who knows more than us, that is really a fortunate situation. And we find it in the yoga shala every day. When we go in, Ismet today, she teach me to do Navasana. I don't know Navasana. So because Ismet, she's busy, she has so many students, I can ask Patricia, she is practicing next to me, I can say, hey, how was that movement today? Can you help me out a little bit? I see you've been doing that for a while. So that is one level of teacher. That is one way of beginning to get the ancient information. From the other side, Patricia has been in the same situation. So beginning to help me understand Navasana is her passing the information on and her deepening her own understanding of that. As a teacher, every time we deliver the information, we share the information, we learn once again. We're being reminded what it was all about. The next level is just teacher. And how many of you are teaching yoga or anything? Many people, yes. So there's some studies, I think many, maybe, that proves that the primary power the student can lean into to learn. The principal thing that makes a student learn is their teacher, their inspiration, their interest in their teacher, their connection with their teacher. So I think as teachers, we have to realize that. If we are teaching, it's on us, man. We have to take it serious in that kind. I download a little line here that says, well-documented studies show that the single most important factor affecting a student's learning process is their teacher. And I remember that from my own school years. I was kind of like a dog in school. When I had an interesting teacher, I got good grades. When I had a non-interesting teacher, according to me, then I got bad grades. So I was just like, you know what I mean? Not really able to lift myself any higher than that. At least in those moments, probably still like that. We have to ask Kino, she'll probably agree. Yeah, man, same today. There's a couple of things that I think is important for, maybe three things that is important for us teachers when we're trying to teach. And one is that there needs to be passion for the subject. If there's not passion for the subject, well, how can we pass the fire? You know, so there needs to be that. And then another thing that needs to be is there needs to be genuine interest or genuine care for the student. That we care that the student get this in the right manner. And that the student gets it in such a way, so especially in yoga, so it helps the student in their lives. It invigorates positivity in their lives. And then I think the way we can do that, and also what's a little bit our what our responsibility is to present new ideas, to present the possibility of new logic, to present the possibility of a more, not just pliable hamstring, but pliable mind, so that the student begin to allow, or that we as aspirants begin to allow logics we hadn't thought about before. And just like challenge that little bit, push into that little bit, because let's face it, logic is awesome, but there's so many of them. If you don't know it, just try to notice next time you have an argument with your spouse, you will notice many arguments are there, many logics are there, not only one. All right, and then there's one more thing I thought to say about teachers and also gurus is that I think it's important for a teacher to create a situation which is comfortable for the student to learn, that is interesting for the teacher to learn, where curiosity can sprout. But we're not just trying to be entertaining, we are trying to get real knowledge across. So we have to find a way to create a comfortable environment, and real knowledge must be passed on. Sometimes I think that's a problem in yoga these days. Sometimes I feel that there is a move towards yoga as petting, as like, we should just come and feel good. It's like, yeah, but that's not going to take us very far. That's what I personally like about Ashtanga yoga. It goes way beyond petting. Just notice Esmeralda's class today. So a friend is maybe first layer, first level that needs to be attained. A teacher, second layer, must be attained in a successful transmission of information. Now, when we go a little bit higher, that's when we start to talk about guru. So guru is not just friend. Guru is not just a teacher. Guru is a little bit higher. First of all, the subject matter is not geography or finances or something like that. The subject matter is liberation. The subject matter is liberation of this human being. If you want to take it a step further, the subject matter is liberation of the student's soul. It's a big deal. So, how do you teach that? How is that taught? You know, it's a good question. So this is about how to live your life, which is based on what is important and what is not important, what is essential and what is not essential. And in the yogic tradition, we say there's many lives, first of all, and then we also say that there's something else than life itself. Life is there for a purpose. Life serves a purpose. Life serves to learn. Learn what and who is learning is the big question. So, from the yogic perspective, there is such a thing as a soul, there is such a thing as a... Patanjali says it in very liberal terms. He says there is a true form, there is a deeper sense of self. That deeper sense of self is what passes from moment to moment, from life to life, and so forth. And the aim of this true, deeper self is to learn. And finally, when we have had all experiences, liberation comes. Not before we've had all experiences, is liberation even possible? Now, mind you, what is being said here is all experiences, not only nice experiences. Yeah, every experience is supposed to be known. When all that is experienceable has been experienced, we are omniscient, does that make sense? Then we are almost godlike. At that moment, Patanjali says, we don't need the body anymore. So, I don't know about you, but I still have a couple of steps to go in that path. Alright, so the guru is exactly that. He is the one that is going to make us understand what life is in the big picture. Therefore, he is called Guru. Guru means the expeller of darkness. So it also means the heavy one. Not as the fat one, necessarily, could be, but as the one that truly sits with substance. So guru means the heavy one, means the one that has the possibility to remove the darkness, to make light happen, to make enlightenment happen, to make us able to see, to make us move from this caved-in inability to experience and see in big and small, and into a place where everything is experienceable. So the idea here again, like in the mantra we say in the morning, is that he's the doctor and he has the medicine that will make us healthy, healed, and so forth. So it's considered a great privilege, a great fortune, if we find a deeply knowledgeable teacher, a deeply knowledgeable guru. Because that person will become like a well for us that we can drink from, that we can go to and learn from for our own benefit. All right, how are you doing? Okay? So we're getting a little big here. It's getting a little bit bigger. You can see this whole idea. So one of the things that in the Indian tradition is very important when we identify a guru. That's another whole subject. How do you identify a guru? Whoa. Do you have the skills to see who's a guru? Can you see that I'm a big guru, for instance? No, I'm kidding. First time I came to India and I met Pratap Joyce. So he's a big, heavy, fat, set man with ashes in his forehead and a little bindu. And he wears the traditional style of clothing, sometimes saffron, mostly white. He has some beads, a mala around his neck. He also has a big golden Rolex on his left wrist, but that's enough. So he kind of looks the part for better or worse. So when I showed up, I thought, this is a yoga master. And I felt in his presence, I felt, this is a master of yoga. And his charisma was striking. He had command of the room. It was very, very clear. There's something going on in this man. So that was very impressive, and I was very inspired by him from the very first day I met him. Then after you practice, you go outside and you have coconut water, but they come in coconuts, not in bottles down there. So, and then everybody's talking. So I started to talk with some of the people that had been there for a long time, and there was a significant amount of people there that was of the opinion that Pratap Joyce was an enlightened human being. For me, enlightened human being is almost like otherworldly. And I was gonna object. I was like, how can you say that, Patricia? It's like, how can you say he's enlightened? And second, I was thinking, how would I know, you know, if he's enlightened or not? So I would start to ask my friends, why do you think, Patricia, that he's enlightened? And to be honest with you, I never thought he was enlightened. I thought he was perhaps working on it, and he was definitely steps ahead of me. And I had great hopes in, I saw him as a man that I could aspire to be. Like, what can you be as a human being when you use your life really, really constructively? And I thought of like that as my David Bowie type hero there. Later that changed, I'll get to that in a second. One of the things that I think is very important, and that ancient text on yoga says, it's like, what is important to be a yoga aspirant? What is important to be a teacher? What is important to be a guru? And there is one guiding principle, and that is the yamas from the Ashtanga Yoga. So the yamas is the very first limb of Ashtanga Yoga, and it says you must live by ahimsa. You must take a committed vow to not live in a hurtful manner. You cannot live in a manner that is harmful. Dalai Lama, he says it fun. He says, don't harm anybody. At least try not to. So that is principle number one. By the way, the Buddhists, they say things better sometimes, I feel, than the yogis. And they call non-harmfulness, they call that kindness. They call that loving kindness. It's just like, yeah, it's a better way of describing it, I feel. The second principle in the yamas, there's five of them, is satya. It means to tell the truth, to be truthful and to be trustworthy. How do you become trustworthy? Well, you do what you say and say what you do. That's the first thing. You make sure that you don't harm anybody, and you do what you say and you say what you do. Then trustworthiness begins to flourish all by itself. Next one is called asteya. It means not stealing. Don't take what is not yours of any kind. So Patricia, she got a new iPhone last week, so I have the old iPhone. So I would very much like that one over there, but it's not mine. So I can't have it. So I have to stick with my old iPhone over here.
It's not so bad.
So there's that, of course, in that principle. It also means that interruption would be such a thing. There would be taking someone else's speech time and so forth. There's many, many ways that we can steal from each other. We can take what is not ours. The next one is the interesting one, is brahmacharya, the one you've been waiting for since I mentioned the yamas. So brahmacharya, brahma means the absolute. It means God, if you are theistically inclined. Or it means everything, the big tapestry within which the construction of God exists, a Godhead exists, and so forth. So charya means to be focused on, to be embedded in, to be interested in, to be exasperated by. So brahmacharya means someone that has their full attention on this higher, bigger, higher consciousness picture. So that kind of person doesn't have time for anything else. So when we're talking about brahmacharya, we are talking about someone that is not very interested in sexual conduct, in sexual activities. And one of the ways that we translate brahmacharya is celibacy. I think that these modern times, in a different culture, in a different time, I think there's a better word for celibacy. I think it has a cultural and outdated principle. I think perhaps one way that I understand it these days is ethical sexual conduct rather than celibacy. At some moment that meant celibacy. Just don't do it. Now these days it is working. We are like, but what we can talk about is sexual conduct has to be of ethical kind. What does ethical sexual conduct mean? It means to be with loving kindness. You need to be trustworthy. You need to say what you do and do what you say. And you cannot take what's not yours. Those are the three guiding principles for ethical sexual conduct. Makes sense? We can keep going. Depending on what grouping, what demographic you are part of, there's different ways of doing that. If you live in South Indian classical Orthodox religious community, then maybe celibacy is still it. But if you live in the Castro district in San Francisco, it might be different than celibacy. You know what I mean? And so forth. If you live in the Middle East, compared to Copenhagen, Denmark, where I live from, it's a very different thing. What is ethical sexual conduct? So, blah, 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 I think you get the picture. Finally, we have aparigraha, which means non-attachment. So we should be non-attachment. So a yoga aspirant, a yoga teacher, or a guru should be non-attached. Are you sure you want to quit all applications and log out now? No, I don't think I want to do that. People in the machine, can you hear me? Are you good in there? Jill, you good? Okay, super. So the last one, non-attachment. So when you hear attachment, I want you to hear dependency. I want you to hear craving. I don't want you to hear, I like that. No, we're talking a whole other level. We're talking addiction, basically. We are talking about that you cannot function if you don't get it. Yeah? So we're talking about that. Here's an example from my philosophy teacher. If you aspire to climb up the Mount Everest, and you train and train for it, but then you learn that up there you cannot have hot tea in the morning, and you are dependent on having a hot cup of, maybe coffee is a better example, a hot cup of coffee every day when you wake up, for many reasons, and then you cannot climb Mount Everest. You have to figure out, am I going to have my hot coffee or am I going to climb Mount Everest? If the coffee is so important for you, well, you have to let go of Mount Everest. By the way, these days I think we have like some small camping version, so you can still have your hot coffee over there, but I'm not sure. So the idea is that there are cravings in our lives that limit us in our happiness, in our ability to lead youthful lives. Those we have to let go of them. In regards to yoga, it is we have to let go of the cravings that is an obstacle to our yoga journey. Yeah? Here's an idea. Oh, I like to go to bed late at night and wake up late in the morning. But Esmith class is at 6 a.m. Oh, sorry, I can't do Esmith class. Oh, so now what do I have to let go of? Esmith class or my craving to watch Breaking Bad till 11:30 p.m. every night? Which one is it gonna go? So depending on our cravings, we have to try to see what is of essential kind in our life and what is of non-essential kind. And Patanjali's proposition is whatever is non-essential, let go of that craving. It's in the way. Whatever is an essential craving, a craving towards essential, I want to have liberation, I want to be able to do Bhujabhidasana, jump back even from Bhujabhidasana. That, Patanjali says, oh, you can hang on to that for a while. Why? Because it takes you deeper into yoga instead of further away from yoga. Yeah? If you want to drink a bottle of tequila every night, that's going to take you further away from yoga. If you want to learn to jump back from Bhujabhidasana, that's going to take you deeper into yoga. Yeah? So you can hang on to the cravings that takes you deeper. You should be letting go of all the ones that is taking you away from you. That's Patanjali's position. All right. So these five, loving kindness, truthfulness, don't take what's not yours, ethical sexual conduct, and let go of whatever is not essential, they are the key factors that must be approached by the aspirant, lived by the teacher, and mastered by the guru. No question about it. According to yogic shastra. Yeah? We call it the big vow. How's it going? You okay? Alright. So, but sometimes this vow is hard to...
So we have the torture on at the other moment.
Okay. You go get tortured in there. So sometimes we meet people that does not live by the yamas. That is very common. Most people in this world is not living by the yamas. It's not interested in living by the yamas. That's fine. But just you then cannot call yourself a yogi. Not possible. So when the yamas is not followed, then we say everything falls apart. That happened in the Ashtanga Yoga tradition. So Patapi Joyce, whom I thought was this epitome of nobility, later on I realized that he had been touching women on their lady parts inside the yogashala in ways he never should have done. So he took what was not yours. He was not living by the yamas. He was not able to let go of his cravings, and he was not living by ethical sexual conduct, and he took what is not yours, and therefore he was not trustworthy, and so many people got hurt from it, so therefore he didn't live by ahimsa. Big problem. So when that happens, it is very, very hurtful for the tradition. Like, it has created a big, many Ashtangis have stopped practicing because of it. Me, for my own part, it is now about 4 years ago since these revelations, since I began to believe that it was true. Up till that, I was like, it must have been a misunderstanding. He didn't touch me, he didn't touch my wife. I started to call my friends, they said he touched me. So, it changed for me. So, so that was problematic. So, what I'm coming into here is, what do you do when we are in a tradition where the ideal situation for the student to learn is to surrender ourselves to the good? Surrender ourselves as in, I don't know why he does this. I don't know why he asked me to do this. But he's so knowledgeable and I know nothing, so I will bypass my own judgment and my own logic in the attempt to meet new logic and therefore grow and develop as a human being. That's the idea. But what do we? How do we find a person that is trustworthy of such trust, of such surrender? That is a very good question. So there's a text called the Kula Arnava, which talks a little bit about this problem. And I thought I wanted to, maybe I could just quote a little bit what this text says about it. So it says, would you do me a favor, would you close that door? Thank you, Patricia. Gurus are as numerous as lamps in every house, but, oh goddess, difficult to find is a guru who lights up everything like the sun. Gurus who are proficient in the Vedas, that is like the Bible, like the primary text of this world, whatever that means to you, textbooks, gurus who are proficient in Vedas, textbooks, books, and so on are numerous, but, oh goddess, difficult to find is a guru who is proficient in the supreme truth. Gurus who rob their disciples of their wealth are numerous. But, oh goddess, difficult to find is a guru who removes the disciples' suffering. You can hear we're talking about the same thing as we talked about earlier. Numerous here on earth are those who are intent on social class, stages of life, and of family. But he who is devoid of all concerns, all attachment, all cravings, is a guru. Oh, difficult to find. An intelligent man slash woman, it's like from another era, right? Should choose a guru by whom supreme bliss is attained, and only such a guru and none other. So, you know, we might sometimes think that the problem of finding qualified teaching is a modern thing. You can hear this is from, I believe, 1150, this text. So this is like 1,000 years old. So even back then they had issues with that. So it's a thing that is going on and on, and it's a thing that we should be looking out for. So when we walk into the yoga room, luckily here in the West, it's not so much a situation of surrendering to a guru. What it is more here in the West, we talk about teachers, and we can be knowledgeable teachers, we can be masters, or we can be new aspiring teachers. Both is possible. But whatever we do, some deference of authority from the student to the teacher is necessary. It's just the way it is. And when we do that, it's possible that the person that we thought knew doesn't know. So what do we do then? It's even possible worse than that. So what happens when the person in front of us doesn't know in the yoga room is we get hurt. Maybe because their movement cues was wrong, or maybe because what Patapa Joe's was, that they did not have ethical sexual conduct. You can get much worse than Patapa Joe's. We have, what's his name? Bikram, who took it to a whole other level. And so forth. And when that happens, when these unfortunate things happen, that happen all the time, from your local corner shop, yoga shala, to the highest guru that walks around in saffron clothing in India, then trauma is the result. And when these things happen, it becomes devolution instead of evolution. So it's very unfortunate. So my proposition to all of you, especially you women in this room, is take care of yourself. You know, trust, but hold back a little inch, you know? Hold back a little inch on that. So just to not end on that note, what could we, how could we detect a friendly guy? Besides cross-reference with the yamas. The Buddhists have a thing that they say should be present in any teacher, high or low. And they call it Kalyana Mitra. So Kalyana means good, true, virtuous, noble, beneficial, constructive, so forth. And Mitra means friend. It comes from the word Maitri, which you might know from the sutras, which means compassion. So Kalyana Mitra means a good friend, someone that has your best interest at heart. That principle needs to be there from practice buddy to teacher to guru. So a guru, a grand teacher in the Buddhist tradition, the base layer of that is Kalyana Mitra. It is the good friend, the benevolent friend. And the Buddha goes even further. He says that such a relationship is quintessential for on the spiritual path. And it goes back to the whole idea that the teacher cares about the student, cares about the student's well-being, and cares about the sacred knowledge. And that the sacred knowledge can do even more good for the student. So in that regard, the guru and the teacher's role is to learn the student to be constructive, to teach the student constructive behavior. And that is constructive thinking, constructive speaking, and constructive behavior towards themselves, towards other people, towards life itself. So happiness can be achieved in this lifetime, and enlightenment can be achieved in the big picture. Without it, it becomes difficult. So therefore we say that the wise teacher and the devoted student is as good as it gets in yoga. That is the foundation for good spiritual path in the yoga teaching. And then let me quote my teacher one more time, Professor Rao from Mysore. He says that for a successful spiritual journey, that is, there's different people that is responsible for that. So the student is responsible for 25% of the effort of that. The student's effort constitutes 25% of the spiritual journey. The teacher's effort is another 25%. Your friends, your community, your practice buddies is another 25%. The support of a sangha, we call it. That there's someone you can talk to, because God knows your uncle is not interested whether you put your leg behind the head or not, right? So who are you going to talk to about it? Well, you know, your teacher is busy teaching, so if you have some other people you can discuss for hours about, you know, whether you should clench your anus in backbend or not, you know, that is equally interested in that. That's very useful. And then the last thing is time. That we must give it time. So I will do the best I can. My teacher does best I can. I have a support of a community that says if I don't show up, they say, hey Tim, why didn't you show up for 6 o'clock? 6 o'clock is my torture this morning. We were all there. It's like, oh, sorry. Then tomorrow, when I don't want to get up, I think, oh, Patricia, she's going to bother me again about it. So then I show up. So I have some support. And then when that is there, then we gotta give it time. You cannot just come once and expect to be able to do all 6 series. You have to come at least 2 times. Then you can do all 6 series. Maybe a little bit more. So what's kind of relieving in this is that I'm just in charge of 25% and some patience. That's it. That's my job. Now, if I don't have a teacher, if I don't have a community, I'm in charge of 75%. Much more difficult. We all tried it during COVID. We had to go home and practice in our bedroom and try not to land on our cat when we jump back. So it's different.
Hey there, it's Kino here. I just wanted to take a moment and thank you for tuning in to my show here on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio. Your support really means the world to me. I'm inspired by the fact that you're inspired and that you tune in each week and keep the inspiration to get on your mat and keep practicing and make the world a happier and more peaceful place. Remember, you can always practice with me on omstars.com. That's www.omstars.com. If you're inspired to read my books, you can check those out on any available online bookseller. Just search for my name, Kino McGregor. And my newest book called Get Your Yoga On is perfect for beginners. You can check that out. Otherwise, stay tuned and I'll see you next week.